they're still trying to figure out, like all world leaders, what are the specific policies from the White House.
The Japanese Prime Minister makes a U.S. visit. It's Friday, February 10th, and this is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us for a greater program experience by logging on now to VOA Asia on Facebook. Also ahead, China opens the mail but still waits by the phone. Media verification in Indonesia, profiting from pollution, and hoping to weave a new future. The future is now on today's VOA Asia. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe becomes the second world leader to meet with President Donald Trump. The two will hold a White House summit later today, followed by golf diplomacy at Mr. Trump's Mar-a-Lago Club in Florida. Mr. Trump's decision to withdraw the United States from the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement, his criticism of countries with huge trade surpluses with the United States, and calls for greater defense burden sharing has caused concern in Japan. Before leaving for the United States, Mr. Abe's government reported Japan's trade surplus hit a 9-year high, powered by improved exports. While in the U.S., Mr. Abe may propose cabinet-level talks on trade, security, and macroeconomic issues. Jeffrey Hornung, a fellow at the Washington-based Saskawa Peace Foundation, tells VOA's Victor Beatty a key objective of his visit will be to build trust.
Trying to build the trust with President Trump, given some of the campaign rhetoric he said on the campaign trail, really caused a lot of anxiety in Japan. Another one is to pick up the pieces from the TPP that President Trump killed. And toward that end, there's rumors that Prime Minister Abe will be bringing a package of some sorts that could create up to 700,000 U.S. jobs through some private-public investments.
Interesting that he's probably, if my memory serves me, the second world leader to visit Mr. Trump after British Prime Minister Theresa May.
Prime Minister Abe was the only world leader, to my knowledge, that met with President-elect Trump. He will be the second world leader to meet with President Trump. And this is all very much a part of Tokyo trying to reinforce the message to Trump that Japan is very important, that the alliance is very important, and that a lot of the rhetoric that he said during the campaign was in fact mistaken.
Yukio Akamoto, a former Japanese diplomat with ties to the Abe government, said what we, Japan, want to know is Mr. Trump's attitude toward China.
Again, they're still trying to figure out, like all world leaders, trying to figure out what are the specific policies from the White House, especially regarding China, one of the big ones. And so the fear is that given how much President Trump has talked about the importance of making deals and negotiating, there's an anxiety in Tokyo that he may want to cut a deal that some people call the G2, essentially the U.S. and China divvying up the Asia-Pacific with spheres of influence based largely on economic rationale, but also having geopolitical consequences as well.
What about the defense burden-sharing issue?
We saw that Secretary of Defense Mattis went there last week and reassured Japan that the alliance is pretty much going to maintain the same trajectory that it did before the election. Of course, burden-sharing has not gone away. I would be surprised if they did not at least begin talking about that because, again, along with the economic issues, Abe really has one target there and to sort of shore up the alliance. And the minute that he starts broaching the topic of the alliance, I would be surprised if President Trump did not at least say, hey, at some point we're going to have to talk about burden sharing.
The two leaders' time on the golf course is seen as symbolic given that Mr. Abe's grandfather, a former prime minister, played a round of golf with then-President Dwight Eisenhower in 1957. These are among the top Asia stories trending right now on VOAnews.com. Pakistan says India's alleged secret nuclear city threatens regional peace. Manila shantytown fire leaves more than 15,000 homeless. Iranian refugees find community in a Jakarta church. Amid economic slowdown, China faces challenge of creating quality jobs. Japan donates generously to refugees, but takes in few. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. We continue now with VOA Asia. A Chinese foreign ministry spokesman Thursday said Beijing commends President Donald Trump for his letter to his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping, in which he looked forward to developing a constructive bilateral relationship. The state-run Global Times called it a sign of goodwill and part of a trend of more positive signs in a restrained attitude toward Beijing. Mr. Trump thanked President Xi for his post-inaugural congratulations and wished the Chinese people a happy Lantern Festival and prosperous Year of the Rooster. Still, the two leaders have yet to speak by phone. And that, of course, has stirred conversation. So I got on the phone with VOA Beijing correspondent Bill Ide.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing here, Jim, is that he's even spoken with Russia. He's spoken with a lot of the U.S.'s allies and others. The phone call to China has not come up yet. And so that has, you know, some people, especially China watchers, kind of scratching their heads and wondering, you know, when is this going to happen? And so we spoke with some analysts about this. We tried to find out, you know, what's going on here. There's some interesting things that were said. I mean, some people think that part of this is a tactic, this is part of this bigger negotiation here that Trump is going to pursue with China to try to take a tougher tact with China because of trade practices and other issues that he wants to pressure China over. And so by not speaking with China, he is in a way exerting some pressure. The concern, though, is for some is that given the complexity of the relationship and the importance of China in the bigger scheme of things, not speaking with China is something that some see it could be a problem.
Mr. Trump has communicated with China indirectly using Twitter, making a lot of statements that has provoked some reaction.
That's true. And that's what some are talking about here, is that if you don't make a phone call, all these things that are building up, you need to clear the air a bit here. You know, that many of the analysts that we spoke with acknowledged that, look, you know, it's a phone call. It's going to be very formulaic. And we know from the Chinese side that it's typically kind of making statements, not really a communication per se. But the fact that they could speak with one another is something that analysts see could help toward the clearing the air, because there is a lot that has happened since Trump was elected. To be clear, the two did speak shortly after Trump was elected, but then there was a series of things that happened that really made China a lot more concerned and nervous about the Trump administration. And that includes his phone conversation with Taiwan President Tsai Ing-wen, and then also his comments, as you mentioned, on Twitter about the one China policy. It's up for negotiation. And of all the things that's happened, that's probably the one thing that China is worried or concerned about the most, is one China principle that it has long seen as the bedrock of the relationship. On the one hand, the two of them not talking is something that is seen as, you know, could clear the air and it kind of help assure each side that the relationship still is heading in a positive direction.
President Obama had two very high-profile summits with Xi Jinping. And, of course, there are always the annual meetings that take place that presidents attend, like APEC and ASEAN. Of course, those will be coming up later in the year. But you really kind of have to lay the groundwork before you even enter into those things.
That's a great point, Jim. And that's another thing that we are going to start looking into. Because, you know, you have all of these contacts, and it's not just the big meetings, but it's ministerial level or different departments in the United States. They have a wide range of contacts with the Chinese government and strategic and economic dialogue, for example, which is a massive meeting. I think last year there were about 16 different departments heads that, you know, attended that meeting here in Beijing. And it's something that's been going on since the Bush administration and really was ramped up during Obama's time in office. And that's something that I guess now the next meeting would be in D.C., technically. But if you're going to hold that kind of a meeting, given the current climate and the things that Trump has said, you know, you really have to wonder if it's even going to continue. Most of the analysts that we spoke with also mentioned that, and they said that there's probably going to be a serious revamp of these kind of contacts and the way two countries communicate with one another. And how they will communicate with one another is also something that's, you know, still very questionable.
While we await the phone call between Donald Trump and Xi Jinping, we're glad that we could make the phone call to you, Bill Ide in Beijing. Thank you.
You're welcome, Jim. Always a pleasure to speak with you.
Happening now in Asia, Chinese police have rescued 32 Vietnamese women sold as brides to Chinese farmers in an operation aimed at curtailing the practice in rural areas. Bride trafficking is a serious problem in impoverished areas where buying a bride is cheaper than paying the traditional Chinese dowry. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're happier with us today on VOA Asia. Indonesia has instituted a new media verification process as the country celebrated National Press Day on February 9th. VOA Asia's Steve Miller discusses the program's origin and aims with VOA Indonesian service reporter Leonard Triyono.
What is media certification, and really, what is this process trying to achieve?
Well, that's a good question, actually. The so-called Dewan Pers of the Press Council of Indonesia, which is supposed to be independent, recently published, as you know, a list of what it calls verified media outlets, both print and electronic media. And according to the council, which has been confirmed and supported by the what they call Union of Press Companies in Indonesia, there have been 74 outlets that have been verified so far. However, they asserted that this is only what they call the first phase of verifications. Another phase is now going on. The Press Council anticipates that the whole process will be completed within 2 years.
How did this media certification program come about? Why is it needed? And is this something that the government initiated?
It is not initiated by the government. The Press Council is an independent entity. It's an independent council. Membership are chosen democratically by members of the media. It's unlike in the past during the authoritarian government of former President Suharto, when they were all chosen or appointed by the government, and they would serve to be a censor body probably for the government. But now it's pretty independent. But the reason they want to do this verification is because they said it's badly needed in view of the numerous sites these days that claim to be media sites, but in reality, in the assessment of the Press Council, are actually fake news, fake companies.
Are all media organizations required to go through the verification process?
No, it's not. They are not, actually, but it's suggested, strongly suggested.
So if it's not compulsory,
it
why
is not.
Go through it?
Well, actually, it's for their sake. Why? Because while it is not compulsory, it's good for them in a way that in times when they need to contact somebody, I mean, a news source, for example, to interview a source, for example, probably, most likely, they would be asked or they will probably be checked whether they are verified, because once you are verified, it can be said that probably you are trusted by the media council as a viable entity.
Does the verification process guarantee that the journalistic organizations are professional?
Well, yeah, in a way, yes, because they said that the verification is a mechanism to make the media healthy. That's the term they use, to make it healthy. And it is done by the press community itself, so as to avoid outsiders, as they said, including the government, to impose requirements according to their standards to make the media healthy. And of course, there are some criteria to make the media healthy, like the legality, whether it's founded as a legal entity, and whether the news production is something that conforms with the journalistic codes.
Leonard Triyono is from our Indonesian service. I'd like to thank him for stopping by the studio today.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news alert from VOA Asia. A Malaysian ship carrying 2,300 tons, or rather 23,000 tons, 2,300, that's right, of food and medicine to help Rohingya Muslims in Myanmar's Rakhine State was met with protests. Organizers are hoping that the Burmese government will help deliver that food as promised. This story and more on Steve Miller's Asia in a Minute on VOA Asia Facebook. VOA Asia continues. An optimistic saying promises there's a silver lining behind every cloud. So too, apparently, with smog in Beijing. While authorities promise to spend billions of dollars to fix the ongoing air quality issues, there's no quick fix. But residents are finding ways to cope and adapt. As Faith Lapidus reports, some have turned Beijing's air pollution into money.
Not even a month into the new year, Beijing has already had numerous days of especially hazardous levels of air pollution, blamed mainly on the burning of coal and vehicle emissions. Beijing residents are used to wearing masks outside, but Yan Bokio wanted to know about inside air. He developed a portable air quality monitor that detects a range of pollutants.
As I measure, I can see that pollution actually comes straight from here.
His startup company, Air Visual, also uses big data to forecast air pollution around the world and shares a 3D real-time global map of pollution and weather patterns on its website.
Especially, I see some quite dark spots here in China.
Bokio does consultations in schools, hospitals, and offices, testing the air and looking for gaps in doors and window frames, and advising clients how to lower pollution levels indoors. You can see the outside pollution levels in Zhu Yi's photos. Every day since January 2013, he has documented Beijing's air quality and uploaded the picture to social media. His photos have now been seen by hundreds of thousands of people.
Through taking photos, sharing them with internet friends on Weibo and WeChat, communicating with people, I noticed that everyone is changing. I am changing as well. Now I no longer complain. Now I work with scientists to find the reasons for the pollution.
Zhu says learning about the pollution has helped him cope with it, and he wants to continue spreading information to the public. This year, he set up an NGO called Beijing Air Now and is teaming up with scientists to develop technology to determine the air quality just from a photo. Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Developing at this hour in Asia, a UN human rights investigator says there are signs of increasing public opposition to Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte's war on drugs, but warns the thousands of killings in the campaign had given rise to a sense of impunity, which could lead to increased lawlessness and violence. VOA Asia keeps you informed all day on Facebook at VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, the recent exodus of Afghan refugees from Pakistan has pulled the rug out from under the local carpet-weaving industry. The Pakistani city Quetta was once known as a bustling market for Afghan carpets made by skilled labor. It's now left with just a handful of weavers. Even they are barely managing to survive due to economic challenges and fear of being forced to go back to Afghanistan. Ayaz Gul reports from the provincial capital of Pakistan's southwestern Balochistan province.
These two young Afghan children are skillfully weaving this average-sized carpet with their tiny fingers. It would take them about 3 months before they complete it and sell it to support their poverty-stricken refugee family of four. 15-year-old Rahmatullah says the rug will earn them about 14,000 rupees. That would pay for rent, food, medicines and raw material until they weave and sell another carpet.
My father is sick. My mother is sick. Now we both are working, me and my young sister.
Rahmatullah is one of millions of Afghans who sought refuge from conflict and persecution in neighboring countries. For years, his family's weaving skill helped them survive in exile.
It is not profitable, and we are barely surviving.
He says that fears of forced repatriation to Afghanistan have added to the problems. After hosting them for several decades, Pakistan is now pushing all Afghan refugees to return to their country, and more than 600,000 of them went back in 2016 alone. Pakistani traders say the Afghan exodus has also deprived local small carpet weaving industries of skilled labor. This has led to a significant decline in carpet production, even though demand for them remains high. Local exporters want Pakistani authorities to arrange work visas for refugees who are equipped with carpet weaving skills so they can stay. But they also admit tension in bilateral ties has lately discouraged support for extending the stay of Afghan refugees in Pakistan. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Quetta.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Be sure to check us out on Facebook if you're not listening to us there already. VOA Asia is the place to go. And we also thank all of our listeners in Myanmar for checking us out on Facebook on VOA Burmese. Thank you so much. You can also find us on our website at voanews.com. Our director is Tracy Carter, our engineer Jimmy Cook, managing editor Diane Gao, and a shout out to our great VOA Asia team, Steve Miller, Ali Ogden, Eli Zimmerman, and we welcome our newest intern, An Ying. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day ahead.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has once again condemned Russia's action in Ukraine following an escalation in fighting between government forces and Russia-backed separatists in eastern Ukraine. Speaking publicly for the first time before the United Nations Security Council, U.S. Permanent Representative to the U.N., Ambassador Nikki Haley, deplored the fact that the United States must repeatedly condemn the aggressive actions of Russia.
It is unfortunate because it is a replay of far too many instances over many years in which United States representatives have needed to do that. It should not have to be that way. We do want to better our relations with Russia. However, the dire situation in eastern Ukraine is one that demands clear and strong condemnation of Russian actions.
Eastern Ukraine is not the only part of the country suffering from Russia's aggressive actions. Ambassador Haley pointed to Russia's occupation of Crimea and called for its immediate end.
Crimea is a part of Ukraine. Our Crimea-related sanctions will remain in place until Russia returns control over the peninsula to Ukraine. The basic principle of this United Nations is that states should live side by side in peace.
Full and immediate implementation of the Minsk agreements, which the United States continues to support, she said, is a clear path to restoring peace in Ukraine.
The Minsk agreements require the disengagement of forces and withdrawal of heavy weapons from both sides of the contact line. This is the formula for a sustainable ceasefire. Pulling back forces and taking heavy weapons out of this area will save lives. The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe Special Monitoring Mission must also be granted full, unfettered access.
Ambassador Haley noted that both Russia and Ukraine supported the Security Council's unanimous call on January 31st to return to a ceasefire. It is the first time in years that this council was able to come together on Ukraine, she said. The United States expects that those who can influence the groups that are fighting, in particular Russia, will do everything possible to support an end to this escalation of violence. The United States stands with the people of Ukraine who have suffered for nearly 3 years under Russian occupation and military intervention, said Ambassador Haley. Until Russia and the separatists it supports respect Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity, this crisis will continue.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.